So my name is Patrick Buchan. I'm a doctoral student in regional planning and an organizer this year's Detroit School Series. And it is my pleasure to introduce Paul Drouse and Julie Roddy. Paul is Director of Public Administration, Director of Public Policy, and an Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Michigan Dearborn. And Julie is Chair of the Department of Health and Human Services and an Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Paul and Julie conduct collaborative interdisciplinary research on a range of urban issues, from substance abuse and incarceration to economic development and landscape change, using a combination of ethnography, social network analysis, and microeconomic analysis. Their work is distinguished, I think, by their willingness to enter any social situation and probe any topic. Together, they have published nearly a dozen research articles on Detroit, which provide a refreshingly bottom-up view of what's going on in the city, as opposed to so much of the top-down kind of theorizing we usually see about Detroit. And today, they will present their ongoing ecological research on post-industrial Detroit under a revised title. I look forward to a fascinating talk. So please join me in welcoming Paul and Julie.
Thanks, Cooper. Before we start, I want to ask, is anybody in here, who in here is over 50? So I want to ask your permission, all of you that are over 50, for us to be able to speak. Do I have your permission? I learned this from, David? I got your permission?
Yeah. Okay. I'm afraid not.
Sure.
I'll go back to my corner. I learned that from, I spend an inordinate amount of time inside the Michigan penal colonies doing classes and so on, and I got invited to do a Kwanzaa presentation, or Kwanzaa talk, last year. And that was the practice I learned that is in that community, to, when you speak, you ask the permission of your elders to do so. I think it's actually a great example of both humility and civility, two things that I think we need more of today. So this is mainly going to be me talking, although Julie's going to step in here and there. We do most of our research together, sort of side by side, but we have different projects that we take the lead on, and this one is kind of at mine. This quote is one that was in my house growing up. I think my mother hung it up there. It's supposed to be an American Indian proverb. I'm not sure if that's actually an American Indian proverb, but that's how it was labeled growing up. And I was thinking about this and speaking about this talk, putting it together last night, because in a couple different levels. One is because the research that we do, and I think it was sort of like this in the first place, but it's gotten more like this. Our research has gotten more embedded, more embodied, more granular, and more particular. In other words, we've gotten more interested in the very, very particular areas of things, and not so much interested anymore in the general theories as much. So I am going to have theory in this talk, but a lot of this is going to be a kind of a journey itself. So I'm happy that you are willing to go along with us on this little journey. So I'm going to make some reference to the original title later on in the talk, but I'm going to have a couple quotes in here that kind of show where this line of thinking started. As Cooper mentioned, a lot of the research that we do. Julie's also going to make sure I keep on time.
Yes.
Okay. So this is a quote, and these are a couple of just things that people said around me in the weeks before I was originally putting this presentation together. And these were not things that were solicited by research or anything. And this was one. This is actually a guy we know pretty well. He's lived in the east side of Detroit for more than 20 years. And he was just showing people, including myself, a picture of the building where he lives, which is an old warehouse that he's fixed up over time. He lives there. And he said, this is the building right here when I bought it. He's showing the picture. Bums and crackheads and pigeons and everything. Okay? Does that work?
It's supposed to.
All right. There we go. Other way. All right. This is another something I heard somebody say in that same period of time. This was last summer. I actually had my class out at an urban farm in Detroit, and we met this woman. She's a regular presence at this farm. Well, she's a neighborhood resident. This farm has been started by people who actually come from outside of Detroit mostly, but she's a neighborhood resident. This is on the north end of Detroit. And I thought this was just really interesting. She was talking to my class, and she was showing them around, and she said, it's kind of like being in the city, but not in her neighborhood in the North End. It's like being in the country and the city. The store is open till 2 a.m., but you got to fight through possums and raccoons to get there. I feel like the raccoons are city raccoons. They formed a gang. And she said, the pheasants, they ghetto as hell, too. There are kittens living in houses all over the neighborhood. I had a cat ran off with some street hooker. So she goes, and she goes. And so what was really interesting to me was how these ideas about both people and about animals and the natural environment are all kind of like circulating side by side. The idea that the bums and the pigeons and the crackheads were all in the neighborhood, in the environment. And they're all being referred to in kind of the same way. In some ways being linked together in ways that makes them at least rhetorically kind of interchangeable. Okay, so our questions that we're considering today then is kind of based on this sort of starting point in our own observations is the kind of just very literal question of how are things like dogs and weeds and things that we've sort of historically studied together, drug users and dealers and other people, renters and homeowners and poor neighborhoods, how are they related in everyday reality? Not only metaphorically, right? This is a lot of, and what part I'm going to talk about today are the metaphors that have infiltrated our language, especially in sociology, the ecological or natural world metaphors. Or in terms of their shared stigmatization, because that's a big issue here as well. But as co-residents of a shifting landscape, and I put landscape in caps there because I got... there's a sociologist named Rick Scarce. He's an environmental sociologist. And he uses that convention. He puts in a capitalizes landscape to highlight the fact that landscapes are, in fact, human natural co-creations, right? So every landscape is something that is human beings, at least the landscapes that he's talking about, have shaped, okay? This is a quote from Matt Gandy, who is, some of you may have heard of him, he's the editor of International Journal of Urban and Regional Research. He's done a lot of writing on metaphors of cities and on cities themselves. He writes, it's paradoxical that although modern cities are frequently evoked in organicist terms as bodies or organisms in their own right, cities are at the same time widely perceived to reside outside nature or the natural order as parasites or monsters. So the human ecology metaphor of the Chicago School of Sociology, which Gandy is referring to here, has been much criticized. But at the same time, social scientific writing continues to evoke these kind of natural metaphors, while at the same time, in many respects, placing cities outside of nature. So those of you who are familiar with the Chicago School of Sociology may be familiar with this diagram. It's probably one of the most famous diagrams out of urban sociology and urban studies, right? And this is considered one of the sort of foundational documents, I suppose, of the ecological paradigm, at least in sociology. So basically, this was Ernest Burgess's vision of the city of Chicago with these different zones. And what's important to note here, there's a slum zone, an immigrant settlement zone, an apartment house zone and a single family dwelling zone, and his theory was that over time different groups moved into different areas, and then as they became settled and their circumstances changed, they would move out. And he used the model of invasion and succession, which actually they had taken directly from plant ecology. Okay, so the idea of the foundational ideas of the Chicago School were in fact directly borrowed from plant ecological studies that were going on at that time in the city of Chicago. This is just another example of the kind of mapping that was done by Chicago School researchers. This is actually a French researcher showing distribution of different types of people throughout the city. So the Chicago School sociologists had this idea of the city as a kind of an ecological area that had different kind of zones within it, very much analogous to sort of biological zones or climates, and that different areas are favorable to different types of people and different types of activities. So this is kind of what I'm referring to when I talk about the ecological paradigm. So this is from Harvey Warren Zarbaugh's The Gold Coast and the Slum. This is a picture from what's now, if any of you are familiar with Chicago, this is a very, very wealthy area of Chicago now. It was not at that time. He begins with this evocative physical description of the Chicago neighborhood, now that was then known as Little Hell, okay? Followed by a discussion of the Sicilian culture that had come to occupy it. From the various towns of western Sicily they have come, settling down again with their kin and townspeople here until the colony is a mosaic of Sicilian towns. So what he talked about in the ecological, in the Chicago School studies often would use, would look at the city as a patchwork or a mosaic of different zones. But looking back at this from my standpoint today, what I noticed was that they're really talking about the city as a kind of a flat backdrop into which these cultures are filling and entering into and defining. They're not necessarily looking at the backdrop itself all that much. So the natural world, especially, is hardly visible. It really functions only as a metaphor, as a backdrop for what's culturally happening. So the ecological zones for the Chicago School theorists were really of human social zones. They weren't literally ecological zones for them. This is some of the theory. I'm just going to kind of skim over really quickly if anybody's really interested in this. The idea of ecology and ecologies has also gone through several phases, and there's two sources I'm referring to here. One is Felix Guattari's Three Ecologies from 1989, and what Guattari is talking about in his Three Ecologies is how there's an ecology of the environment, of the actual sort of tangible natural world. There's an ecology of social relations, which would include institutions and organizations and actual networks of relationship. And then there's a register, he calls them registers, a register of human subjectivity, which has to do with how our minds interact with both of these things. And all of these are linked together for him and his notion of ecology. Okay? On the other hand, you have different notions of ecology that have evolved throughout the history of sort of urban studies. So the human ecology paradigm is that Chicago School paradigm. Industrial ecology is a later paradigm that looks at cities as being, again, as organic superorganisms that basically suck natural resources and build things and then expel natural resources back to the environment. So in the industrial ecology model, nature is very much considered, but it's basically considered in terms of inputs and outputs. So it's a very kind of a mechanistic model. In urban political ecology, which is actually not so much residing within sociology as in geography and political science and a few related areas in urban studies, there's more attention is paid to the kind of the interrelationship, but a lot of the focus of urban political ecology is on relationships of power. So a couple examples of sort of recent studies that I've looked at and have been influential in my thinking on this is Paul Robbins' book Lawn People, which is really a representative of this urban political ecology approach, looks at how the production of lawns in suburbia is, in fact, something which is a political economic kind of an industry at the same time that it's also made possible through subjectivities of people that invest in these lawns, right? So he looks at lawns as basically something that we don't even think about because we're surrounded by them as a sort of complex political social production, right? Zach Falk is an environmental historian and wrote this wonderful book called Weeds, an Environmental History of Metropolitan America. He's got some great stuff on Detroit in there, including maps of where all the ragweed was when they would go do the anti-ragweed campaigns in the early 20th century and so on. And one of the things that Zach Falk maintains is that basically the war against weeds is a futile war. It's already very similar to the war on drugs in a lot of ways, which is convenient for us because it crosses over into things that are near and dear to our hearts, right? But nonetheless, the idea of weeds, the idea of weeds as a kind of an index of social disorder, which goes back to the Chicago School, and the idea that certain areas of the city are less organized than other areas, and that's evident in terms of the things you see, right? The way people act, the things you see in the environment. So neighborhoods that have more weeds in them and more garbage in them are signs that that neighborhood is more disorganized or more disorderly, has a certain kind of sets of behaviors that are more prevalent in it, and those are all interrelated in the Chicago School. But they weren't really interested in the weeds themselves, okay? The idea of weeds as being an index or an indicator or being associated with negative things is still very persistent, though, I would argue, and that these metaphors are still very much with us and inform our thinking, both in terms of everyday people, right, and people in everyday discourse, and also in terms of sociology and social science.
Show them the giraffe.
Oh, yeah, anybody see the giraffe?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's through us. When we were out there looking around, it's through us.
Wow.
You didn't know there were giraffes in Detroit?
This is in a field.
It's actually a former school. Some of you are familiar with that school. It's Northeastern High School, I believe. It used to be there. It's now a big field. And we were walking through the field one day, because you'll see in this study, it's really based a lot of it is on walking through fields and things. And this was there, you know, and I was like, whoa, what is that? It's a giraffe. We actually later figured out there's an artist that goes around and plants these things in different places.
And we plotted in there and got our picture taken with
the giraffe. So Gandhi argues that the ecological imaginary, which is how he refers to these metaphors of the natural world that are very, very persistent, comprises a cluster of dichotomous ethological. This is theoretical. So let me ethological and neo-romantic readings of nature remains rooted in organical conceptions of urban space. The dynamics of urban change are widely conceived in terms of an adjustment towards a notional equilibrium state, or the set of processes that must be realigned towards a putative set of natural parameters. Now, what does that mean? So, to me, that was that got me thinking about the ways in which we use ecological metaphors all the time without even thinking about them. So, even if you think about the notion of sustainability, and I'm a big believer and practitioner of sustainability. Like, who isn't, right? Sustainability, you close the loop, so everything's balanced, right? If we're going to create sustainable communities, we're going to create sustainable programs. It's all really a metaphor. I mean, because if you look at natural environments, you know, some of them are sustainable in that sense that we're thinking of. They're balanced, they reproduce, they only consume what they produce. But there's others that aren't, right? So it's like natural systems are sustainable until they're not, right? Until some aspect of that community becomes unsustainable and then it collapses and something else takes over, a transition happens, right? So the whole notion of sustainability, a lot of the things that we refer to are actually really organicist or ecological metaphors. So I got really interested in what are actually ecologists doing in cities? What are they looking at in cities? Because we were, like I said, we're getting more interested in what's actually around us as opposed to like all these highfalutin ideas about how the political economy has produced this and that, and neoliberalism this and neoliberalism that. I'm really just trying to understand what's in front of me. What are they doing? Because are they actual scientists? They go and they look at what's there. At least that's the way I think. So I started looking at some of the things that people found, and so I found studies on urban rat ecology, tree cover, and perennial vegetation. Has been linked to social class and capital. Avian diversity, in Chicago, a study found that neighborhood income and housing age were inversely related to native species richness. Okay, in other words, that the proximity to undeveloped land patches enhanced species richness, but native species richness was, native species were more rich in lower income areas than in higher income areas. Why would that be? I'm not totally sure. I think it has to do with the things that are available to eat. It's the same thing with rats. The reason why rats are in some places, we have negative connotations with rats, right? Rats are connotations of disorder. But what is negative about a rat? I mean, a rat is where a rat is because there's food to eat for a rat to eat and there's a place for a rat to hide, right? So I learned recently that Detroit had something in the 1940s had something like a population of several million rats. It was somebody we saw present rats recently talked about that. Yeah. And what was interesting to me is then going around, and you'll see some pictures in a second, the Detroit today is that I don't see, actually, even though it was in my original title, I don't see hear a lot of people talking about rats. I'm sure there are rats and people have problems with rats. One of the things I started to wonder about is this habitat that we're going to see, is it actually very good for rats? Because you think about the habitats that are good for rats, there are ones where people are densely concentrated, where there's lots of food and lots of places to hide. A lot of Detroit is very, very open areas, and there's actually predators in a lot of these areas. So, I mean, it's interesting to me, and I'm not a rat biologist, as to whether or not how rat populations are distributed. A recent study that was in a journal called City and Community, they did a whole issue devoted to Detroit. This was an article by a woman named Laura Reese. She's from Michigan State, but I think she's an economist, actually. But she looked at the feral dog problem in Detroit. Really, really interesting article. And this is no joke in Detroit. There was a young boy that was just mauled yesterday, I think, by four pit bulls, who, interestingly enough, I don't think were feral. I mean, they weren't loose. They were not stray. They were owned by somebody. But she examines the feral dog problem, and she primarily looks at it in relationship to the concentrations of
organizations, right, and is an index of poverty. Okay, so she really looks at how she looks at the response to feral dog populations in from a kind of a lens of networks of organizations. So again, she's really looking at it, and this is the thing you see, I think, in social science, and social scientists look at animals in environments. They tend to look at them as indices of something else. So if we look at weeds, we're looking at that as a possible index of something like social disorder or poverty or something like that. We're not necessarily looking at the relationship between the weeds themselves or the relationship between weeds and people. In geography, they actually do a lot of interesting stuff with animals. They have a whole field called animal geography, which I really sort of started looking into. And this was a study that was done in Hull, England, of feral cats. And what they found here was that how people define cats living out of doors really varied depending on who you were talking to. So that they said that cats, the categorization of feral urban cats was very, very slippery. You know, it related to the wider issue of what in the constitution of space is defined as belonging or not belonging. Okay, so I got really, really interested in this when I had the opportunity last year to sit on a thesis review committee for a woman in Paris, France, who was doing defending her dissertation on the relationship between people and pigeons in Paris. I got invited to be on her dissertation committee because we met her at a conference in Amsterdam, and I don't know why she selected me, but she did. She wanted a social scientist from the United States. And they actually, let me tell you this, if you sit on a dissertation committee in Paris, or in Europe, a lot of places in Europe, they'll actually pay you to come there and sit. They don't give you, I mean, they'll pay you, they just pay for your expenses. But anyway, I got to go to Paris, right? And I read her thesis and I commented on it. And what she does is really, really interesting. She explores both the subjective component of cultural attitudes about pigeons, and she looks at the pigeons themselves and how people actually relate to pigeons. So when I was there in Paris, and so after reading this thesis, and I had a couple days of hang around in Paris, I really started paying attention to the pigeons, right? And so this is in a pretty well-known public garden in Paris. Anybody know Paris?
Luxembourg?
Yeah, the Jardin du Luxembourg, right? So here I'm just kind of panning around. These are all the people hanging out. And I'm just really just watching what the pigeons are doing. And so what she really looked at was how the pigeons as a community really key themselves to what people are doing, right? They adapt and they're really well suited to these urban environments. She actually looks at some of the ecosystem services provided by pigeons. Like the pigeons actually provide a free cleaning service. We think about pigeons as being dirty, right? But she thinks about all the things that pigeons do, right? So it's just a really interesting way of looking at, and she was also looking at how our notions about things like pigeons tend to inform our notions about other things or be informed by those notions. So the idea of pigeons as pests, for example, pigeons as a nuisance species, they become defined as a nuisance species. What does that mean? Are pigeons natural or are they not natural? Are they part of the human environment or are they part of the natural environment? So it opens up some really interesting questions. Then if you look at plants, there's a lot of things that have been done around distribution of plants in different places. This is an article from Belt Magazine, which is out of Cleveland, Ohio, and I love that. It's an online magazine. By Anne Schrubeck, she's the editor of Belt Magazine. They did a story on the distribution of wealth and the distribution of trees in the Cleveland area. And so she found things that, which to a lot of us in social science would not necessarily be surprising, that people who have more money actually have better trees and healthier trees. So some of the areas that are the wealthier areas in Cleveland actually have a much higher concentration of tree cover and so on. But she also talked in the article about her relationship to trees that she never really thinks about. So this is just a short quote from the article. A few months ago, I started thinking about moving to the city of Cleveland proper, but I kept rejecting the idea because as I surprised myself by thinking, I would miss the trees. I did not know until that moment how important trees are to me. My relationship to them is subconscious, only bubbling up to the surface when I think about their absence. So that got me thinking then about some of the people again in Detroit that we've met. And this is the same woman that I was talking earlier about, the ghetto pheasants, so on. And when we had our students out in that garden, she actually spent a lot of time talking to them. And she was telling them about the different trees, the black walnut, and the qualities of the black walnut. And then she said, I thought this quote was really interesting too. A lot of the stuff that you see here, right, is not just nature springing up, but the remains of people's houses. That's Mrs. J's old house over there. That's her apple tree. The house is gone, but the tree is still there. So to me, this really captures something important. It's not just nature springing up, okay? Nature was never absent in the city in the first place, but its presence in Detroit seems to be increasing. So, you know, visually it seems to be increasing. But what does this actually mean, and what is happening among these different co-residents, right? There have been some other really interesting stories on this. Bill McGraw, who's a writer for the Detroit Free Press, who actually lives in Dearborn, did a very interesting study of urban moundscapes in Detroit, looking at the plant cover on these mounds, which are basically illegal dumps that have accumulated over years and have been grown over with different kinds of plants. And this is my colleague, Professor Oren Gelderloos, who was quoted in this article from National Geographic saying, "You can't go planting petunias here," he said. "The soil and water aren't great. These are hardy, hardy plants." Okay, so I got really interested then, for all these reasons, in what's actually happening in these different environments. And so our approach, as I mentioned earlier, is based in our two disciplines, but it's gotten sort of more, you know, maybe I'll let Julie step in and talk a little bit about what our approach is. We use a flexible interdisciplinary approach, but she's going to talk a little bit about the methods we've used that form the basis for what we're going to share.
All right, thanks. Yeah, I didn't say methods, I said approach, sorry.
Approach.
So I can talk a little bit about it. I think what Paul's presented to you today are different ways that we've thought of the neighborhoods. That we don't go into the neighborhoods thinking these ideas. We've got three different neighborhoods that we've been primarily walking around, I think for the last 5 years, and looking at the landscapes in those neighborhoods and trying to come up with ideas. And this is just a set of ideas that we've come up with. But the approach that we use, it's flexible, it's interdisciplinary. It's attuned to both the physical and social landscapes and other factors. I'm an economist, I'm constantly looking at the economic environment as well. And when we interview people, we take both an ethnographic interview with the people and an economic interview of them in the neighborhoods. We focus on three main drivers of change in these three separate neighborhoods that we look at. We look at population loss and or the gain in that area. We look at the private, public, and nonprofit development strategies that are in those areas, and we try and separate the neighbors according to those, just kind of seeing if there's any difference. And then we look at the expansion of urban farms, the forests, and the green spaces that are around, trying to see, you know, if that's impacting the behavior of the human beings. Initially, one time when we started out and we were looking at these three neighborhoods and we knew that we wanted to compare them, what we had started to, we knew there were interventions going on in the neighborhoods, and we started to think, if we see these neighborhoods change and decline, and we see the green, we see more green space grow or green space take up, will that change the behavior of the human beings? Like, we know when a neighborhood starts to go into decline, we can see interactions of human beings. We know when a neighborhood declines, we'll see more substance use, and that was primarily our focus initially. And we wondered if when more urban gardens came back, where more organized spaces were put in, would we see substance use decline, or would we see those people just evacuate the neighborhood? We were kind of wondering, does it affect human behavior in the opposite direction? So these are the three neighborhoods that we've looked at. We've looked at the Hope Village, that's kind of the west side of Detroit. We've looked at an area that we call Recovery Park, that's just because of the intervention that was going on in that neighborhood. It's a grassroots intervention of urban farming in that area off to your right, I guess. And then we've looked at an area in the southwest, Oakwood Heights, which would be in the Delray area, which would, it was distinguished for us because there was a large intervention by Marathon. They were buying out houses and clearing the lands. So we wanted to look at these three separate areas. And Hope Village, I guess, was significant to us because there was a major anchor nonprofit that was trying to impact the community in that area. So Paul has talked to you a little bit about our ideas about patch dynamics and socio-ecological, the socio-ecological interface. So we look at the changes that are driven by governments, the nonprofit sector, the industry and business, grassroots effects, and that's the social arm going in there. We look at the interface and the feedback between the social and the natural environments. The interface and feedback between the social structures, the environment, the behaviors at the local level, and then we look at changes in landscape and land cover, the soil, the air, and the water quality in those areas. Wow. Yeah, there we go. Again, we're looking at some patch dynamics, right? Looking at the patches of land, that patch structure of land. And this is the neighborhood of Recovery Park that I showed you in 2010 compared to 1952. That's a little faint. And you can kind of see the elements of change. Look at how much more green space there is in 2010 than what was available in 1952. So this is Shane Street, a very popular street in 1952, anyways, and it's a representative street in Detroit of a lot of decline. So it shows the impact of the structural abandonment and demolition of the houses on neighborhood and physical structures and the social structure. So we've also done quite a few interviews in that neighborhood when we, you know, wander around and we talk to people. So I'm going to let you pick up again here, Paul, in urban vacancy and land use.
Okay. So, and this was an article by Joe Nassauer and Ellen Raskin, I think it is?
Yeah.
It sort of laid out a kind of a whole agenda for doing research in post-industrial cities. I really loved this article, and I recommend the whole thing, but I really just sort of fixed on this one part. But she had a bunch of different suggestions, so how social scientists, and she's talking about actually urban planners, because this is coming out of urban planning, might investigate these post-industrial spaces. And here she talked about using large contiguous areas of vacant land as habitat may provide patch sizes adequate for uncommon interior dwelling species, right? But she also goes on to say it may also provide patch sizes adequate to allow for unwatched human activity, including criminal activity. That's my emphasis that I had there. So one of the models that we've used, we've developed for different studies we've done, have developed different ways of modeling what it is we're looking at. This is, you know, I'm not going to go through all the different boxes. This is another one for an NSF study that we didn't get funded, but we're still working on it. But basically kind of looking at these dimensions of population decline and then substance use over there, and then sort of these represent kind of higher order phenomena that are measurable at sort of the, you know, the aggregate level or the institutional level, and these are sort of more kind of localized phenomena. So in looking at enhanced quality of life and neighborhood resilience and green space expansion within particular environment. So we had a bunch of ways of trying to get at these different things.
And data sources.
So what we're doing here today is actually showing you. So this is the framework we've been working within as researchers. The rest of what we're going to show you is basically kind of quotes and pictures. Okay. So that was kind of the hard work. The foundation has been laid, hopefully. So thinking again about all these kind of complex interrelationships that are visible and observable, and you hear people reflecting in the ways they talk about their different communities. That's mainly what we do, is we observe and then talk to people. So this is from Elijah Anderson. This isn't from somebody that we met. Well, have I met Elijah Anderson? I've been in the same room. I don't think I've actually met Elijah Anderson. But I was interested in this notion of drug infestation, right? Because people would use this term. We hear this term all the time. It's a drug-infested area, right? Even people that we interviewed in the community would say, this area is drug-infested. I was like, well, where does that come from? Where is that? I was trying to look for the first citation I could find. I think this is one of the first citations I found from 1991 from an Elijah Anderson article called Neighborhood Effects on Teenage Pregnancy, later included in the Urban Underclass collection by Jenks and Peters. And I'm like, oh, aha, of course. This is when I was getting my PhD, and everybody was talking about the urban underclass. And one of the things I looked at in looking at this underclass literature is the way the underclass were talked about almost like a separate species. But you think about what infestation means, because I go up and I looked up the origins of the term. It has to do with an infestation of pests, right? It's a biological. It comes from the sort of from biology, from animal biology, the notion of infestation, right? So then I looked at what people were saying about their own communities. This is somebody from that Oakwood Heights neighborhood, or this is actually from the Hope Village area, talking about people, these different other people in his community. They just roam around here. This whole area used to be beautiful. I mean, it really did. It used to be clean over here. You didn't see many hookers, drug needles, used condoms. You see a lot of mental insane people over here. You didn't see all that. But you did see them, they was in a van, okay? Another guy had asked, because one of my questions is just, I just used very open-ended questions. How would you define this neighborhood to somebody that's not from here? How would you define this neighborhood? And this is the first thing this guy said. That neighborhood And this is a neighborhood where he didn't associate with it, although he hung out there every day. He went back and he lived somewhere else. It actually wasn't that far away. But he's talking about the neighborhood where I met him, which was where he was hanging out. And he said, that where the dope fiend would be hanging out at. That's where they'd be hanging out at, the dope fiend and the prostitute. It's where they hang out at. At one time, before you all came over there, man, there used to be so many girls hanging around, round and round through there. It was pathetic. Okay, that was on the east side. This was a guy in Hope Village who was talking about what's happened in his community where he'd lived for many, many years, in his home that he owned. He said, it's not normal. You know, before it was not normal to have a crack house in your neighborhood. It's just like you're numb to it. I cut off some more. He's talking about the powerlessness that he feels. It's like you're numb to it. It's like you just, you know, you're used to it. Like if you were in Africa, you're used to seeing wild animals, you know. So it's like you become used to it. So, I mean, get just really interested in how these metaphors would crop up in the things people were saying. And we weren't asking people, you know, these things. This was just asking them to describe the neighborhood. So I mentioned earlier the idea of invasion and succession, which is that it comes from plant ecology. You have certain groups that come in when an environment becomes cleared out, like, say, by a fire, and then you have a group comes in to succeed, you know, an invasion and succession. And I started thinking about how invasion and succession metaphors are all over the place. Think about what these guys are just saying. You hear these stories all over Detroit. The neighborhood used to be like this until this group of people started coming in and then became like this, right? You actually hear it all the time around gentrification. Gentrification is all informed by invasion succession, you know, metaphors. This is an Oakwood Heights neighborhood, right? Talk about invasion and succession, right? This is where a Marathon, which funded this huge expansion of their refinery, decided that it become intolerable for this neighborhood living right next to them, that it was worth funding these people to be able to leave their homes. So Marathon funded, bought out 80% of the homeowners in this neighborhood and proceeded to bulldoze the homes, many of which were in deteriorated condition. But we went and interviewed a bunch of people in Oakwood Heights before they moved out in the process of going through this buyout process. And this is another narrative of decline. And I'm not going to dwell too long on these because we've got other things to say. But there are a lot of these narratives of decline that focus on how this used to be a beautiful neighborhood, and then they'll talk about the different steps, stages, the things that happened. Just went down to the ground, right? It just went down. This is something you hear people say a lot. I asked him, what's a neighborhood like now? And this is what he said. It's like pulling the hair out of your armpit.
Got to try that.
It's a pit, yeah. No. And he talks again with Merritt. He talks about the pollution as well. Okay, you've got all this pollution around here. You got gangs running around. It just went down. It's like nobody cares for anything. So I mean, you have the metaphors that are also present in the old Chicago school work. The interconnection between how people think about their community, their social cohesion, and the physical conditions are tied together. But they're not really thought about in terms of what's, you know, they're mainly conceptualized in these social terms. And this is the actual bulldozing of homes in Oakwood Heights. And you see what the neighborhood starts to look like after many of these homes are gone. And we were there one day, and we talked to one of the security guards from Marathon. Because if you walk around in this neighborhood, the security guards will come up to you.
I mean,
who are you? So we actually got we had the phone number of the security guy. And so when we go to the neighborhood, we'd say, it's Drouse and Roddy from U of M Dearborn. We're going into the neighborhood, just so you know. Yeah. And then they usually come by, and then they like to have small talk and stuff like that. You know, there's people too. There's security guards. And this guy we were just standing there, and we were looking around. And he goes, it looks different, doesn't it? And one of the things we found is that we're spending time in the neighborhood after a lot of these homes have been cleared out. One thing that people talked about was the cats, the number of cats all over the place, because a lot of the cats no longer had anywhere to live. Or anywhere to shelter. So you had one family that started feeding the cats. And all the cats were coming to this one house to get fed. They had like rows of cat food out in front of the house. But we were really interested in how people were relating to the environment around them, just sort of on a day-to-day level. And this was these are some pears from a pear tree that one guy who was still in the neighborhood, actually he's still there because I went and talked to him last month. He lives right next to where this pear tree is. And he considered himself to, he didn't own the land where the pear tree was, but he felt like it belonged to him. Marathon owns that land, but he's still able to take pears from the tree. But he talked about the value of the trees to him in terms of the reason why he likes living there. And he actually talked about how he likes the neighborhood now because it's peaceful, right? there aren't anybody else around anymore. He's got this huge refinery next to him, but most of the other people are gone. And then Marathon is now replanting much of this neighborhood with new, they're planting native trees here. But Marathon is, these are, when I was there one day when Marathon was planting these trees, and the protesters were there protesting Marathon's contributions to the neighborhood in terms of pollution. So again, we're interested in how all these elements are existing together. And the geese are all over the place, right? The geese and turtles, that's in the river, which is right there, the Rouge River, and this is a groundhog, which has made a very comfortable home. So we're interested in the animals, in the life of the animals, and the relationships people have with animals. And of course, relating people to animals has a lot of negative connotations historically. Describing people as animals, right? But we don't often think about what does that say about animals, right? So if we're describing people as animals and that says negative things about people, we're othering people by calling them animals, but animals are like the original others, right? Now how do we relate to animals? So this got me thinking about how we relate to animals. And I started thinking about different things in my life. This was a guy I knew in Chicago back in the 1990s. His name was Bobby Jean. I found this old photograph. I had scanned it. And he told us this was a dog that was a neighborhood dog that everybody knew. The dog didn't really have a home, but everybody in the neighborhood knew this dog. The dog, he said, was named Maximilian. And Max was not owned by anyone, but it was known by everyone, right? He told me about how Max was a mixed breed dog, had once whipped a pit in his younger days. The time when I saw him, Maximilian was growing old. You can see he's getting old there. But was still known and respected on the street corner. So I got interested in the ways that people relate to animals because I live in a suburban area. I have a dog at home. We're used to relating to animals in this one particular kind of way. And we think if animals are not being treated in that particular way, that they're being treated inhumanely, right? Which in some cases they may be. But when I started looking at animals in the landscape, and I'll show you some pictures of dogs in a minute. This is in one of the field on the east side of Detroit. Now, this is a Polish photographer that I took there looking for pheasants. He wanted to find pheasants. But you start to see there's lots of things in these so-called vacant lots, right? Do you see the pheasant?
Yeah, I see it.
So we did eventually flush a pheasant. Do you see it? You can hardly catch it. It's a flutter right there. It's a pheasant taking off, right? One gentleman that we met on the east side talked about how he sometimes would eat pheasants. I eat cattails, the bottoms. And then right behind there is like a swampy area where cattails grow. And I probably kill 3-4 pheasants a year. They said, how do those taste? He said, they're good. You got to remember, they just eat insects. So I don't care if they're in the city or in the country, they're eating the same diet. This is an older man on the northwest side of Detroit. Talked about in his neighborhood, which had a big open area behind it, people used to live in all those houses back there, but they're not there anymore. You could go back there now and hunt pheasants. So like I said, I'm living in the country, in a city, and I love it. Yeah, I love it. People feed the pheasants. People leave food out for the pheasants. This was one guy that was showing me a place where we could find pheasants, because again, I was looking to get a good photograph of a pheasant. And they would put all this food out every day to feed the pheasants that they'd kind of, like the colonies and families of pheasants that they'd become familiar with. So then, is a pheasant still a wild animal? Right? According to our purified definition of a wild animal, when it's being actively fed, even though it's outdoors, right, on a daily basis. This is a woman talking about her neighborhood on the east side and how peaceful it is. She took a friend to her neighborhood, and we came back here, and we sat on the porch. You can hear the birds singing, and you can see the fireflies and things. And it's like they look, and they say, oh, I understand. I understand why you're living here, or why you're still living here. So you have these different relationships that people are expressing with the natural environment and with even with the animals around them. And of course, a lot of times, the wild dogs are referenced in a negative way. This is the same guy that was eating the pheasants, talking about, I've been attacked by wild dogs a couple times. You got wild dogs attacking people because you've got blocks and blocks and nothing, right?
So you have people describing the same areas, some with positive metaphors and some with negative.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And of course, that can depend on where their position is or where they're at in the neighborhood, right? This was walking through on the east side. Now, I don't know if you can see the dog here. Can you see the dog? Okay. This was really interesting because Julie and I were just walking in this neighborhood. This was actually where the Hans Farm, Hans Woodlands planting is taking place. But we were interested in how this is interacting with the people around it, how people are interacting with it. And this house, which was visibly abandoned, actually was occupied. It had a family of dogs living in the house. Because I remember when I went, this was the female. I think you can't see because of the shadows, but there was another dog in the doorway. And when I stepped closer to that house, that dog made it very, very clear that I wasn't supposed to come any closer to that house. And there were puppies in there, too.
We
could hear the puppies.
Yiking.
So there's a whole family of puppies living there. So every time I go through that neighborhood, I sort of look at that house. And this is, you can see the Hans Farms plant right here. But this is on the same block across the street. There's a dog just hanging out, right? You start to notice these dogs. Now, does that dog look unhappy to you? So I start thinking about, well, you know, we can talk about feral dogs as an index of social disorder or the decline of the city and how horrible that is, what that represents for people, but is that necessarily a bad thing for dogs? And so for a lot of dogs, it is. A lot of dogs' lives don't end well. But I started thinking back in my life, different places where I've been and how people interact with animals, and it's very, very different, right? So I spent some time on an Indian reservation in Wyoming a number of years ago, and there the dogs all lived outside, and they had relationships with the dog, sometimes even names, but they wouldn't humanize the dog, and the dogs would get run over, things would happen to the dogs. But the dogs, if you interacted with these dogs, they were living the life of a dog. They were living a very full life of a dog. And a rancher, I have a good friend who's a rancher, it's the same thing, that most of their dogs, except for the favored ones, live outside. The real ranch dogs live outside. They had like a basset hound that lived inside, right? Because they raised the puppies and they sold them for money, because there was, you know. But when I was staying at their house, this was like more than 20 years ago, and we had dinner, and it was chicken, and they took the chicken bones and they threw them out in the backyard with the dogs. And I said, I was raised, you know, as a dog owner in the suburbs, you weren't supposed to give a dog chicken bones because a dog can choke on the chicken bones, right?
Right.
And I said, you just gave those chicken bones to the dogs? He's like, can't they? He's like, he looked at me, he's like, they're dogs. He's like, they know how to eat a chicken bone, right? And so, and I don't think he was disrespecting. I'm going to let Julie do the cats. Julie's big into cats, so I'm going to talk about what kind of time do we have?
We don't have much time at all.
I don't even know what time.
Julie won't talk much on cats. But these are just a pair of cats that we
okay,
saw.
So this is one on the east side of Detroit. It has a mouse in its mouth. I don't know if you can see that. He's just walking down the sidewalk. And then I watch him just turn the corner. And he goes up. It looks like he's going to a barn.
Going home. Right, he's going to go home.
Okay. So that's on the east side. This is on Hope Village. Did you see those?
Of course I did. Coop, you're the one who showed me the cats, right? You're the one who introduced me to the cats there.
Oh, that's, yeah, they were behind.
Remember? Yeah.
Yeah, remember.
So that's me feeding those cats because you introduced me to them. But go.
Wait, no, I thought there was another cat in there. I thought I had a cat from every... Oh, we showed the one in Oakland Heights. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I got some more theoretical terms. In other words, I'm starting to think about, you know, invasion, succession. These terms are still with us. Sort of think about terms like deterritorialization. This comes from Deleuze and Guattari. But what I'm really interested in a lot of these neighborhoods is a kind of a slippage between what we might call control space and non-control space. So instead of thinking of these as urban versus rural versus suburban, I'm starting to think in terms of a spectrum of human domination. So some neighborhoods, some environments are less human dominated than others, right? And here you can actually see where they come up against each other. Somebody's been tending this part of this lawn. This is what, you know, Deleuze and Guattari are talking about, a territorialization. You're marking it out, and you're sort of making it into a structuring it. Whereas this is kind of loose, slippery space. This used to be a driveway to a house, right? So this represents a block that used to be full of houses, and now you see these driveways that just lead to this. So that, to me, is that's deterritorialization. What used to be very strictly territorialized, marked out by humans and dominated by humans, is no longer so dominated by humans. It's still a socio-natural environment. It's still social and natural, but it's less human-dominated, right? In that same, we're doing this very cliche thing for white people in Detroit now, I'm afraid, to go looking for pheasants, okay? So I was looking for a pheasant with this Polish photographer, because he wanted to see a pheasant, and we were walking through this, this is Hans Farms, that's re-territorialization, gardens, right? Some animals, I think, represent re-territorialization, not deterritorialization, because people are bringing in farm animals. This is in Brightmoor, and that one's on the east side of Chicken. The weeds also represent, you know, different types of things. I've learned more about the different plants that you see. So some of these, like Queen Anne's lace, is very, very common on the east side of Detroit. Don't ever go and pay for Queen Anne's lace in a florist shop if you're anywhere near Detroit, like in the springtime, because it's all over the place. And what I learned is that Queen Anne's lace does really, really well undisturbed landscape. So it's one of those colonizer species, right? Somebody's planted alfalfa. What's alfalfa?
On the east side. Wow. Yeah.
So,
you got time.
Trees of heaven. Did anybody know what trees of heaven are? Okay. It's a really interesting name of a particular plant. It has another name. It's also called a ghetto palm. it's called that because of the way it takes root and it grows very, very aggressively. And so this is actually just a blog site I found online. Guy talking about his least favorite plant, the tree of heaven. Riding on the Amtrak train in San Joaquin, I discovered a new metric. The economic health of the city can be judged by the size of its trees of heaven. The higher the ghetto palms, the more likely a city is to be in the crapper. Okay? Right, so again, I mean, using plants again, but primarily thinking about them not in and of themselves, but as an index or something that they represent in terms of the social state of the city. And then, you ever heard this book, Tree Grows in Brooklyn? Right? I remember seeing this motif in cartoons, Tree Grows in Brooklyn. It was like in a Bugs Bunny cartoon, Tree Growing in Brooklyn. So I think Bugs Bunny was from Brooklyn.
Right.
So, the tree, and a tree grows in Brooklyn, is a tree of heaven tree. I just found this out, right? And the reason, the story is about an intergenerational family of Irish immigrants growing up very, very poor in Brooklyn, and they had this tree growing in their yard, and they tried to kill this tree. Over time, the tree would always come back. So, this is a story that takes place over generations about sort of resilience of people. And this tree in the yard that the men chopped down, this tree that they built a bonfire around trying to burn up its stump, this tree had lived, right? So this tree is actually kind of a model of resilience. It's a model of what David Quammen calls weedy species, right? Weedy species exhibit these different characteristics. They reproduce quickly, they disperse wildly, they tolerate a fairly broad range of habitat conditions, they take hold in strange places, and they succeed especially well in disturbed ecosystems and resist eradication once they're established. This, to me, is really, really interesting, thinking of the metaphors to humans and plants and animals. They are scrappers, generalists, opportunists. They tend to thrive in human-dominated terrain because in crucial ways they resemble Homo sapiens, aggressive, versatile, prolific, and ready to travel. Okay. So, of course, we had to go and find some. So I'm like, we got to go find some trees of heaven. Of course, you don't have to go very far once you know what they look like to see them. This is one that we found. This is on St. Alban Street. And this house was actually, honestly, it was still smoldering.
Yes.
When we were there, so that's, you can see the size of this one. There's a place in Hamtramck called the Tree of Heaven Woodshop, which has taken the Tree of Heaven as kind of their symbol for precisely this reason. It's anarchic invasiveness. It's a significant plant of post-industrial landscapes. Photosynthesizers, and Zach Falk's book, by the way, which again I recommend. I know his dad, so he's a friend. But when he talks about weeds, he always refers to them as photosynthesizers.
Instead of weeds.
Yeah. resilient photosynthesizers, right? So this is really interesting. Think about farms and weeds. This was in Hamtramck, the Tree of Heaven Woodshop. It started a Tree of Heaven farm, a ghetto palm farm, where they're actually growing trees of heaven in a farm format. Does this represent deterritorialization or reterritorialization, or both at the same time? It's sort of taking this agent of deterritorialization, which is this aggressive tree, which will invade any landscape and transform it, and kind of reining it in.
So it's like a weed farm.
Yeah, like a farm of weeds. But they're actually using them to make things. Okay, that's their shtick anyway. Do you want to talk about hotspotting and resilience?
No, you can do it.
So what was the use of all this, right? So this has been kind of a wandering thing. I think you probably sense that at this point. So we've started to think about what possible use could this be. So one thing we thought about is, at least in sociology and social science, we're often thinking about concentrations of things and aggregations of things, and what do we do about those things, right? Even going back again to the Chicago School, like these are disorganized neighborhoods, these are organized ones, these are the ones we need to target, where we need to target our interventions and so on. But that's a kind of a reactive approach, right? Now it's called hotspotting, right? You're trying to figure out where the concentrations of things are, and then you're focusing your efforts. But what if you instead looked at, sort of systems overall and sort of normality, right? The backdrop, the unnoticed backdrop of things, as opposed to like the sort of the obvious concentrations of things. And so if you look at what's being said about resilience, and resilience in many ways is kind of the next phase of sustainability, right? What resilience says, the concept of resilience says, is that unlike the sustainability concept, which suggests that we can achieve some balance where everything will simply reproduce itself and be in balance, right? Again, which is an ideal, that if we strive towards resilience basically implies that there is no one order that's going to prevail indefinitely, right? Every environment is capable of changing, is in fact, if you look closely enough, is probably already changing, mm-hmm. right? So that if we become more oriented towards change that's taking place along this kind of broad spectrum of relationships, resilience then is a way of thinking about the ability to adapt, the ability of systems to adapt. So thinking about weeds and animals and weedy species and the human beings that are often associated with them, because when we talk about people in the landscape, I was going to say something about ponds and soup. Ponds, I learned recently from a biologist on my campus, are all different. There are people who study ponds, but you can study and learn everything about a single pond, and only a fraction of the things you learn about that pond will be generalizable to other ponds. Okay? This tends to be antithetical to what we want to do in social science, historically. We want to be able to find the things that are generalizable. We want to abstract up to find a level of generalizability. This is, we want to be able to say something about this neighborhood or this block that then is also true about another block over there that has these same shared characteristics. But if you go in the direction of ponds and soup, we work with a researcher at the School of Medicine,
yeah.
And he talks about some of our research, like, you know, it's a soup, right? Like, we look at human beings are a soup, actually. Every soup is different. So a soup is a bad thing from a researcher's perspective because all these things are mingled together. What we want to do is we want to abstract out the things that are like, you know, the key variables. You want to isolate the key variables. What's the variable that's most important? And what the soup and pond approach suggests to us is that you can't really do that. I mean, you can do it, you can abstract stuff out, but you're always going to be missing something about the actual place, right? So if you move in the direction of more pondy and more soupy, you're actually embracing the particularity of the place. So I tried to do I was too tired to do this using PowerPoint. So I created so think about these things, farms, pheasants, trees of heaven. You've seen pictures of all those things now, right? They're all there, and they're in the same areas. They're there together, right? Think about our original title, which was Weeds, Rats, and Crackheads. And it was because, again, not because we were trying to say something, it was because these are things that people were referring to. Bandos is a term that people use to refer to abandoned buildings. So the relationship between abandoned buildings and wild dogs and drug users and drug dealers is something that people often comment on. How they're all connected to each other. And then if you think about, you know, putting these things in actual environments, all these things are existing. All these things are existing side by side, right? And they are all tied together. I don't understand the ways in which they're tied together. And it's not to say that anything is causal, because again, I'm not going in that direction trying to say that trees of heaven cause, you know, wild dogs. But to understand the environment for what it is involves thinking about all of these things. And there's a concept which is a cutting-edge concept in social science now, assemblage, which comes out of Deleuze and is also used by Manuel Delanda. And it's a term that I've used a lot, which is this basically a concept that refers to thinking of things, both human and non-human elements of environments as being equal of not necessarily equal importance, but all of importance. So in other words, from the assemblage viewpoint, if you look at an environment and human behavior, the dogs have agency too. The plants are a part of that too. The abandoned house that has nobody in it is an actor in the landscape. They're all actors in the landscape. We're always focused on the environment as a backdrop for human beings. And we only think of it in terms of how it impacts human beings. But all those things are acting together. And when you separate one from the others, right, you're breaking the assemblage apart and you're doing a kind of an analytical violence, I guess.
It's a soup.
It's a soup, right? But we want to know the recipe of the soup. We're not happy with looking at the soup itself. What I found out when I then looked at the concept of assemblage is this concept itself, this concept is all over ecology. In ecology, they use the term assemblage all the time. And for them, it means something very, very simple. It simply means things that exist together in the same environment. That's all that it means. In other words, it's already, I'm using another metaphor. Trying to get away from metaphors, I'm using another one. So I'm going to conclude with this quote from David Quammen, which I think represents a possible direction for thinking about urban areas. And he's talking about the term the environment and how we use it. This clumsy, confused, and presumptuous formulation, the environment, implies viewing air, water, soil, forests, rivers, swamps, deserts, and oceans as merely a milieu within which something important is set, namely human life and human history. But what's at issue, in fact, is not an environment. It's a living world, right? It's a living world in which all these things are actually bound together and are only artificially separated from each other. So I'm going to stop there. I want to thank you all for your attention, and we're happy to... Yes.
How do you define the difference between an ecosystem? Like when you're talking about assemblage, that was the first term that came to mind. And how did you choose that term as opposed to something that I think of as an ecosystem, which is a term that we use in where you have an assemblage of environmental things?
I think there's probably one as kind of being nested within the other. So I think if you think about ecosystems, that's... So in ecology, too... I think they have the same issue of their problem of non-generalizability. So people that are doing real, like on-the-ground ecology, if they do it well enough, it's not going to be generalizable to anything else because it's going to be so specific to what they've studied, right? So even in natural science, they have this same issue. And I think ecosystem represents a formulation of characteristics that is supposed to be sort of generalizable. Now, you can talk about it an ecosystem, which is that specific ecosystem. Within that ecosystem, I think there would be possibly many different assemblages within an ecosystem, right? But I guess it depends on how narrowly you define the ecosystem. Here, I'm referring to assemblages being these we didn't include, you know, the air and the water, although I guess we could as well. And if you include all that, maybe at some level it's indistinguishable from an ecosystem.
We used to kind of go out and think of the ecosystem as the neighborhood, but I think that we stopped. You know, for a while, that's what we thought we were doing, and then we stopped.
Well, I have a friend he's more of a natural scientist than me. He's a geologist or geographer, and... He gets kind of pissed when social scientists start using words like ecology, like they talk about the nonprofit ecology, the ecology of nonprofits, right? He's like, oh, that's not, because for him it means something really, really, really specific, and you start using it in all these metaphorical ways, like wilderness and other terms that we borrow from natural scientists. So, I mean, I think you need to ask a natural scientist if there is, the way in which they use assemblage, as opposed to ecosystem, if there is a clear distinction, or at some level, I think they probably blur together. But in the articles I've seen, they look at, for example, there's one, I actually cited it in the article here, which is assemblages of plants on urban brownfields. Okay, so I think they're looking at plants that tend to exist alongside each other inside a brownfield setting, right? So I think the ecosystem would be inclusive maybe of other things, but the plant assemblage is something where these things, these particular plants, tend to associate very closely with each other. So I think it's probably a more granular scale than ecosystem. That would be my best guess.
So thank you for this. It's really fascinating. And I hear you still making sense of it and thinking about it. So two separate thoughts responding to what you said. The first is that although you often talk about the theme of metaphor as being the ways we use metaphors from ecology and nature to describe social phenomena, to me actually it was equally interesting to have you report on the way we use social metaphors to make sense of natural phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just lift that up, beginning with the very first comment about the pheasants that be ghetto. It seems to me culturally you're describing a situation where a whole bunch of complicated ecological relationships produce metaphors in every direction, unlike with the original Chicago
mm-hmm.
school. So that seems very rich and interesting to me.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because there's we socialize the animals, that we impose social metaphors on them at the same time that we borrow these metaphors from the natural world.
Well, and I would actually argue, this is a hunch, but it seems to me that the word sustainability is like calling a pheasant ghetto. It's actually comes out of economics and social science, and in the limits of growth moment was applied to natural and environmental processes. And that's, so it's worth thinking about if there's an intellectual history of treating environmental problems with social discourses. And go ahead.
Well, I would say to that one of the urban political ecology works that I read talked about how in natural sciences, he said they're often, I've talked about natural sciences as though they're sort of metaphor free. He actually talks about how they're actually kind of blind to a lot of the metaphors that they employ. And in part thinking that they're not, that they're only doing, science, what's observable. And in fact, metaphors taken from other places, including social sciences, inform a lot of their thinking about, sort of the whole idea of equilibrium or the old notion of a peak community, right? That's what's the term? How many people?
Climax
community, right? And now the whole notion of a climax community in ecology itself is being questioned. There is actually such a thing.
And was in the 19th century was influenced by economic.
Mm-hmm.
Second quick thought: I was really struck that there's a whole generation, as I understand it, of ecological theory in which flows have replaced boundaries and zones,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of absent from, at least the way I heard you talking about it. It feels like you're working with a kind of territory spatial notion of the kind of legacy of environmental
mm-hmm.
thinking, and I would have thought that an emphasis on both human, social, and natural flows might help the richness of the work.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's a great question. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we have other things where actually we have focused more on flows. So the notion of spaces and flows. So cities are spaces of places, and they're spaces of flows.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're both at the same time. Right. So in doing this kind of work and looking sort of at what's actually in the environment at this moment, you tend to be more in that place mode. You're saying, like, here's our terrarium, right? And we're going to look at that. Because it's relatively stable over, a period of time. But, yeah, I mean, there are influences flowing in and out of that. And so when we talked about, we've looked a lot at drug use, right? And drug use is something that people look at oftentimes that's really sort of focused on individuals or groups or places. And really, if you look at what illegal drug use is it's a geopolitical market flow, right? That if you follow the tracks of that drug, if you talk about heroin, there's a lot of heroin in Detroit. Nobody's growing opium in Detroit, not that I know of. And everybody in Detroit will tell you that too.
Yeah.
We don't grow it here. Somebody's bringing it here, right? That's and some people are coming here to buy it too, because a lot of the buyers are coming from other places. So there's that flow, So yes, but I focus more on kind of the spaces side as opposed to the flow side. But you're right, absolutely.
This whole, I thank you as well, this whole notion of social change and Detroit changing. I grew up in Detroit from 1960, on up, and there, I remember the rats. I mean, I grew up over in the 12th and Burlingame, and I remember the rats. And there was just a bunch of people living throughout the city. And then with the population decline, now, I've come back and now I'm living in Detroit after other environments, and now there are more raccoons and possums and things like that. But the second notion, pheasants.
You know who has a big rat problem I just heard?
Who's that?
Pleasant Ridge.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so But the second part is the eastern, you said where people live, the metaphors of those who said how beautiful and peaceful it was versus those who said how horrible it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole eastern philosophy versus a western philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
With a normal western philosophy, don't we normally think of bigger, better, more people, build higher?
Mm-hmm.
Where the eastern philosophy, emptiness, emptiness is a positive quality.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for new things to occur, there needs to be a clearing of something.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody from the West would look at burned out houses and big fields and say, oh, how horrible, it's so devastating.
Mm-hmm.
But with somebody with an Eastern philosophy would say, oh, how wonderful, so
yeah.
Something new can come.
Yeah, right. Well, and you see this difference in terms, and I haven't talked about race in the presentation at all, but I think this actually, you see a racial division on this, and it's not because of anything that's, you know, genetically racial. It's because of places where people come from. So white people that come to Detroit, I think, walk around and they go, wow, look at this, you know, waving grasses, and it's just this weird kind of peaceful, you know, rural but urban environment, and the people that are living there are going like, what the hell are you talking about? We want a mire here. We want all the, you know. So there's that side of it. But then there are people that you learn. One guy actually we interviewed just a couple months ago. It's a guy that is living, squatting in a house on the east side. Older guy. He spent a lot of time, about 20 years in federal prison. He actually he knew the Chambers brothers and a bunch of other people. So it's one of the reasons why we wanted to meet him. You know. And I asked him the same questions. I said, what is it about this neighborhood? What did you say about this neighborhood and how you define it? And he goes, well, it's good and it's bad. He's like, what I like about it is that there ain't nothing around here anymore. So it's kind of peaceful,
right?
It's kind of like being out in the country or something like that. That's what other people said. He said, what I don't like about it is you got a lot of young guys around here. They think they're Al Capone and they ain't.
They didn't know the change.
So you had it on the one hand, it's kind of like he said, most of the time it's really quiet.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty quiet, you know, and most everybody that's left knows each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you do have these kind of, you know, so I mean, you have this notion of problematic populations. That's a whole, there's a lot of actually sociological research on that too, how people assign, you know, sort of, the fault for things in their environment that they don't like to different groups or people or places, right? So you see a lot of that takes place in people's kind of own descriptions of their environments too. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely.
I'm really interested in when you're talking about controlled versus uncontrolled space,
mm-hmm.
Especially uncontrolled space and how you can show it's intentionally uncontrolled,
mm-hmm.
As habitat for animals.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to like a state park or a wildlife refuge, how that's interpreted differently
yeah.
than a place that's not managed either.
Yeah, I mean, that gets into some really interesting areas because, you know, state parks national parks, right, are also, from the standpoint of urban political ecology, are also social spaces. They're constructive spaces, right? In fact, they're managed to be, you know, wild in a way. In a way, they're more managed than some of these spaces are, actually, I would argue, right? Some of them, you know, because these spaces are sort of going just where they're going because of the sort of the agency of these plants and animals that are occupying. They're not going these ways because somebody said, except in a few places, like Greening of Detroit is doing some dendro remediation work. Well, that's actually very, very intentional. That's very structured.
And Hans Farms, too.
That's very structured. I mean, that's a very disciplined kind of a landscape. But you also have these kind of, like, this is just, this was part of my notes here. I just want to read this real quick. While we were wading through this Detroit field trying to flush a pheasant, which I openly acknowledge is an utterly cliched activity. I inadvertently stumbled onto a human dwelling place. I would not have even noticed had my eye not been drawn to a neatly stacked pile of bottles filled with brightly colored soda pop. I tracked to the left across what first seemed an inconspicuous mound until I saw a pair of eyes looking right back at me and the man that they belonged to. Feeling oafish in my invasion of his privacy, I quickly retreated. However, it brought back to me the fact that these vacant lots are not, in any sense, empty of life. Okay, and I would say that in terms of both human life and of the abundance of animal life. But what they are is they're, and I've, so they're human places as well as natural places. But that I, so that's why I say I like the kind of notion of human domination, because it doesn't impose a dichotomy. There's a kind of a spectrum, right? So you can see sort of degrees of sort of human domination of the landscape. I live in Dearborn, Michigan, right? That's a human-dominated landscape in a lot of ways, much more so than... So the traditional dichotomy that we've had in social science is that urban areas are totally human, cities are human constructions, nature is outside of cities, right? Going back to that notion of... And so what you see in Detroit now, and this, of course, people romanticize this too, is this kind of inverse of the notion that the city is the controlled space, the totally human-dominated space, and the country or the rural areas are the uncontrolled space. If you look at environments from across the Detroit region, it's the suburban areas that are most controlled and dominated. In some ways, most polluted, because most of that pollution going into the Rouge River now is from people's lawns and from farms that are big farms, right? So in Detroit, so you see this kind of inverse happening, but at the same time, I'm suspicious of the romanticization, which is all over images of Detroit right now, right, about, you know, the green city, right, you know, and then all this kind of stuff. I mean, I think there is a lot of that, but I think that is also, you know, a human construction. Yes.
So I...
You never gave me permission to talk.
I tacitly did. So I get that you were just looking at the moment, but are you forming any conclusions about what the long-term prospects are for this? It strikes me this is almost a kind of a novel type of space in human history. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not aware of cities that have burgeoned and collapsed as quickly as this has to create a space like this.
Yeah.
And have you started to conceptualize what the long-term future of a place like that would be? Could be?
I mean, it's hard to walk around in Detroit and not think about that.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think in this work, or what we presented here, we're kind of resisting.
Conclusionless.
It's deliberately conclusionless.
Yeah. We're deliberately sort of resisting that. But yeah, I mean, and sort of I've read like a lot of this stuff, you know, what I call, you know, consider some of the kind of the granola utopian visions of Detroit, you know, and versus the sort of, then there's the dream of the return of the glory of Detroit that's going to be fully occupied and the bustling, but, or, you know, there's, you know, so there's all these, and there's the apocalyptic version of Detroit. Mm-hmm. We actually have another paper, it's called Ghost Devils in the Undead City, which looks at how Detroit is pictured.
Ghost Devils.
using horror film images, right? So we kind of use... relying a lot on the way in which Detroit is pictured from outside in these horrific ways, and sort of looking at Detroit through the lens of these different sort of, well, like we look at zombies.
Crackheads.
They're in the zombies section.
Right.
So, no, I mean, if you think about, so how many people remember, you, I'm sure you all remember, even if you weren't old enough, because some of you are not old enough to be, have been alive when the Michael Jackson Thriller.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
But you, that video, I went back and I looked at that again, and I'm like, this is a video about crap.
Right.
That's right.
He's walking through the neighborhood, and all of a sudden, the graveyard, all, because I remember guys in the 1990s, so I've been working in inner city since the 1990s. And people talked to me about crack, and it hit their community, and they'd said, there were women, young women that we knew, that used to be beautiful,
right.
And they'd come walking, they looked like they walked out of the graveyard. That was those were the images they would use, right? They looked like the Crypt Keeper, right?
Right.
And then you would see these images in media, too. But I saw that Michael, and I never thought about that when I was young, when I saw that video. I was looking back at it again, I was like, when did that video come out? So then I had to go look it up. And I'm like, but then if you throw race into it, it gets really interesting. Because if you think about the image of the zombie is a racialized image back to its very beginnings. The notion of the zombie comes out of Haiti, right? Mm-hmm. And so the original images of zombies were very, very, very obviously racialized.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's all these interesting intersections. But then we looked at werewolves, because the wild city, the notion of the wild city. Remember that story about the raccoon man?
Yeah.
You know, these images of Detroit being this, where people are going back, you know, becoming wild. And what else do we go? Of course, ghosts, the notion of ghosts haunting the city. And there are ghosts
vampires,
all over.
Vampires, we have vampires who are in there.
Vampires, because drug dealers. Look at how drug dealers are pictured in mass media and the way people describe drug dealers as being parasites and bloodsuckers and people who lurk around at night and they come out at night and they lure people in and they seduce people, right? So anyway, you guys... That'd be a different presentation.
A little bit about the conclusions. So when we're more firm in what we're
trying to look. So remember when I showed you that the neighborhoods were separated by three different interventions. One was a large-scale nonprofit. One was a large for-profit industry that was clearing out a neighborhood, and another was a grassroots intervention. I think we can say things about what happens to the neighborhood when all these different forces intervene, and which one's more efficient if what you're looking for is change. So I think we can say, we can conclude things about that. And we can conclude things about those concentric rings around wherever the intervention is taking place. Right, dependent upon how much money is being put. I mean, clearly, the for-profit company can get this done and clear off that neighborhood in no
time. Yeah, that was
the
kind of interesting thing, is that the most
offensive.
Offensive, but most, most noticeable urban intervention that I've seen in Detroit is Marathon Petroleum Company coming through and clearing out a neighbor. Security, not a problem. And all those things.
Yeah. We could come in.
That's not that it's a recommendation. That's not a recommendation for that, for the rest of the city. But, if you compare it to, like, the efforts of nonprofits and other things. That was our sort of theoretical frame, is that we would be able to sort of monitor in each community these particular types of factors and then be able to say some things about certain combinations. I guess that would be where assemblages would come in, that might be more representative of one type of area than another area.
And it would yield some conclusions. And
of course, when we're applying for NSF grants, they don't want to hear that you're studying a place just because you really like the intricacies of the place.
Right.
They want to know about what's the theoretical.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, we can spin it that way, too. Here we...
Right.
Well, which one is spin, Paul? Come on now.
Here we just wanted to delve into, like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
Well, when I visited South Africa, in Johannesburg, it was a bustling metropolis. Very tall, large buildings, just like downtown New York, 8 million people. Then Cape Town, no matter how high they built, the homes were very, they were short, colorful. No matter how high they built, Tabletop Mountain just reigned supreme over them, and the ocean on both sides, on the other side. And how that affected the people, there was the tour guide said, the people in Johannesburg are very arrogant. Because as far and as high as they can see, they built it. Those in Cape Town are humble. Because no matter how high they build, God's terrain supersedes them.
That's fun, right? That's a fun story.
So I wonder how that will affect how Detroit becomes. How will that affect the humility or...